All right, everybody, welcome back to The Human Occurrence. I am your host, Brent Phipps. It is currently 7 a.m. on the 9th of January, 2021, here in Byron Bay. And I'd first off like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, past, present, and future. But more importantly right now, it is roughly about 3 p.m. in Canada, and that's where our guest is from. Her name is Mira Simone, or better known as New Moon Mira. And Mira basically caught my attention on the social media platforms for her really raw and real content that she produces there. And I tell you what, guys, it really, really, really had an impact on me. You know, like, it's one of those things where you read it and you have to take a couple of minutes to kind of let that drop and sink into your system. Her content is some, you know, you could call it inspiring, you could call it many words, but for me, it is without a doubt life-changing, and I'm not exaggerating with that point. So what we do with Mira today is somewhat profound, and she really takes us on a journey from her views on death, her experience with it, and everything along the lines there. So as always, guys, get ready. I really hope you enjoy this episode. It's episode 8. Let's get locked and loaded. Here we go. Good afternoon.
Can you hear me? Hi. How's it going?
I'm good. I'm just drinking my coffee and slowly waking up where you're doing the opposite. You're kind of getting ready to...
I'm drinking my tea.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm drinking tea and... getting ready to chill out today.
Hey, it's really nice to have you on, Mira. It's
nice to be on.
Yeah, it's kind of like we kind of had a couple of calls there where it didn't work out, and but now we're here, so it doesn't really matter. How's your day going?
Right. It's okay. Yeah, you know, up and down. It's okay. Yeah. We just got back. So we're in Northern Ontario right now, my daughter and I, and so we don't usually live here, but we've been here a lot throughout the pandemic, and it's really cold and really sunny and clear, and we just went out skating.
Oh, great.
And it was really nice, but so, I'm really cold.
And your daughter's name, is she Dee?
We call her Dee, yeah.
Dee, right.
Yeah.
Right.
We call her Dee for short. Her name's Davida.
Wow, that's a beautiful name. What does that mean?
Thank you. Davida. It's the feminine form of David.
Right.
It's the feminine form of David, and we named her after my dad, whose name is David.
Right.
And so my family is Jewish, and in Jewish tradition, it's sort of like... it's considered bad luck, or like bad from a superstitious perspective, to name somebody after someone who's still alive.
Right.
But we just wanted to do it, and so we asked my dad, and he was totally cool. He was like, "Well, I don't really believe in that, so you can do whatever you want." And so, and he was like very, I think, touched that we wanted to name her after him, and he said, "I don't believe in it," so we did it, and yeah. Yeah.
It's a bit of a you know, having kids is definitely like a it's own rite of passage in its own way. I remember before I had kids, Mira, I was so goddamn naive to life, and I just thought like my plate was already full, and I thought I really kind of already discovered myself. And then I was I was really fortunate to have two home births at home, and to play witness to that was a really transformational experience, as you already know. I actually say to my mates, I'd actually like to experience birth.
That's funny, because I remember after I gave birth to Davida, I remember asking Brian if he was jealous that I got to do it, because it was so awesome.
It's good, you know what, and I think more people, especially empowered women, really need to talk about their great birth stories, because there's more bad birth stories than there is good, from what I've heard, you know, like, and Laura, talks about it a lot, and I find it really empowering, because...
Is Laura your wife?
Yeah, sorry, yeah, so Laura's my wife. I've got two boys, Eli and Zev. Eli's about to turn 3 and Zev's 18 months. And they're wild. They take up a lot of energy, but I just love it. It's just something that is just, it's just, like I said, changed me completely. Mm-hmm. It's just made me whole.
Yeah.
But it's broken me in so many different ways. It's on a daily basis, you know, like it's,
yeah.
You really yeah. get to know what you're about, like what your internal world's about, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I just love, you know, but I'm not having any more kids because I think that you've got to really divvy that energy up, don't you? It's like, okay, you've got some energy for yourself, your wife, your marriage, your kids, your work. And it's, I think more kids you have, the more you kind of have to divvy that up. So I think we're just going to put a cap on 2, Mira. And that is that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, yeah. I mean, I think everybody's on their own, you know, their own individual path with all that stuff. And even with the stuff you were talking about birth, like, you know, I had a pretty positive birth experience too, but I know that also, like, on the flip side of what you're saying, there's a lot of women who, you know, put a lot of pressure on themselves to have a certain type of, you know, quote unquote natural birth. And then if it doesn't turn out that way, it can be, that can be really, really hard as well. And like on the topic of grief, like for sure, a big part of grief, I think, for a lot of women who didn't get the birth that they dreamed of. So I always tread a bit lightly with these types of conversations because I feel really grateful that I, you know, things for me, they worked out. I had a home birth and everything was great. But I know so many women that wanted it and didn't get it, or who maybe didn't want it for multiple reasons, didn't feel like that was for them, and then feel like pressure that they should have, or, you know, those types of things.
And then
it's a tricky conversation for sure.
It is. Yeah, it is without a doubt. And for anyone who's tuning in right now, so there's a bit of a backstory with Mira. Like, I really started following you about 4 months ago. And what really engaged me in your content was basically with how raw and real you were with the processes you're going through. So number one for me, it really related to what I was going through, but I found on social media platforms and life itself, not many people are really embracing that courage. And I'd imagine you must have an absolutely shit ton of courage to be able to, I don't even know if you filter it, but you just, you know, it's just so fluid. I don't know, you know, it's just so fluid and it's real. And I feel like a lot of your posts and words have a lot of ripple effects. And I'm talking out of my experience because it had a ripple effect on me. But it's just really powerful. So I discovered Mira on social media, and it's New Moon Mira, isn't it?
It is. Yes.
Yeah. Where did the new moon come from?
Very good question. So New Moon Mira was my name on social media from whenever I first got Instagram, which was a little while after most of the people that I knew. I was a little late to the game. And I chose it on a whim. I mean, I've always loved the cycles of the moon and felt really connected to the cycles of the moon. And actually how it started was, so as I'm sure you know, like traditionally most women would ovulate with the full moon and then their cycle would come with the new moon. And I had read the book The Red Tent and I really loved that book, and my cycle was always the opposite. So I would always ovulate with the new moon and then get my cycle with the full moon. And then I started I think I'd been reading about it around Instagram, and I was like really into this idea that there were always these very few women within a tribe that were the ones who would ovulate with the new moon, like the opposite of all the other women. And they often had these unusual paths in life, these unconventional paths, you know, they weren't necessarily that conventional sort of like having a million babies and that's it kind of thing. Like they always, it was like they either had some kind of different darkness or difference to them. And it's funny because like back then I was totally leading that conventional life. Like I was in a long-term partnership. I had a baby, or maybe I didn't have a baby at the time, but we were like about to get pregnant or whatever. You know, I was on that path.
Yeah.
And then everything totally fell apart. And now I'm like, oh, wow. So the name kind of has these different connotations for me. And then, so I guess like, I should just like tell everybody who's listening to your podcast right now, like the reason that Brent follows me and what I write about primarily is I became a widow when I was 34, which was just under 2 years ago. And like the love of my life, Brian, who was my partner and we had a baby, and he got a really, really aggressive cancer kind of out of nowhere. And then very traumatically died within just under 7 weeks from his diagnosis. And that's basically what I write about. But anyway, so the new moon connotation kind of took on all of these other meanings within grief, because there's this idea of like the cycles of grief and the waves of grief and how things will crest and then fall. And that how with the new moon, it always feels like this fresh new slate, like this new, and that's how my life felt when Brian died. I felt like my entire life had been wiped out and it was a fresh slate. And that was both horrific and empowering at the same time. And I still kind of go back and forth between those two things quite frequently. And so then when I started writing, which was really not intentional at all, but simply like as a survival mechanism for me, like that was the thing, like one of the only things that actually helped me even momentarily early on was writing and sharing my writing. So it was very sort of non-intentional and I just kind of stumbled into it. But then it's interesting because the name, you know, means so much to me now, and it makes so much sense. And now I'm making a website and a blog. Like I'm in the process of building a website and a blog at newmoonmira.com. And I wasn't even planning on taking the name that I chosen for my Instagram handle and making it like the name of my website, but my name, which is mirasimone.com, was taken.
Right.
And mysteriously by somebody who had purchased it on Brian's birthday a few years ago, but isn't using it.
Right.
And who won't respond to me when I ask like who it is. So I just kind of took that as a sign. I was like, I guess my website's newmoonmira.com. So it's kind of just kind of fallen into place that it's now become sort of like my identity. It's really funny. Like in the grief world, in the writing world, you know?
Yeah. So where did
it's funny.
Where did you get your skills for writing? Did they from the gifts of death? Because what you're basically describing to me is post-traumatic transformation is like after a traumatic event, is that, you know, one can change their identity, they can discover all these gifts that was lying inside of them. So I guess my question is, you must have had some sort of writing ability prior. Did you write? Did you learn how to write? tell me about that.
I've never learned how to write. I have no formal training. So when I was a little kid, I loved writing so much. Like that was my creative tool for sure. And it's funny because all of my friends who have been friends of mine since I was a really little kid have recently reached out to me and been like, you were always the best writer in the class, or I always knew you were going to be a writer. And it's funny, I have this one friend, Lydia, and she was my best friend growing up. Like we were inseparable. And even before Brian died or any of this happened, she would often just randomly message me and be like, you're meant to be a writer. And it was so funny because I literally like did not write at all. I always, once I kind of got out of being a kid and I don't know, it was like a dream that I kind of let go of, because I was like, well, how are you supposed to make a living as a writer? And am I even that good? And I had all of that normal self-doubt. And I felt like, well, what do I even have to write about? I don't have anything to write about. Mm. And all of that, you know, imposter syndrome and all of that. And then also it was really, in my family, it was really, certain things were really valued. And like, I wanted to go to this arts high school, but then I got into this other program that was really rigorous and academic, and was sort of encouraged to do that, and then decided to go get a degree in a profession of occupational therapy, which like
does totally in certain ways align with who I am. And I did it in a really unconventional way, but I always used writing as a tool. So like I started my own grassroots organization that we do life skills programming for teens with disabilities. Right. And I always used writing because I made my own website for the company and I always did the emails and I did all of the writing and the content for the company, which was really great, but I never kind of used it as a creative tool. Right. And then when Brian got sick that very first night when we got the diagnosis after he went to bed, it was like, I just had a visceral urge. Like I need to write. That's the only thing that's, I was going crazy. Like, as you can imagine, just going crazy. I felt like I was going to lose my mind. Like it was such an overwhelming feeling. And so I was like, I need to write. And I found this old journal on a top shelf somewhere. And I just wrote, and then I just did not stop writing the whole time he was sick. As he was dying, I was like sitting beside his bed, sobbing and writing, talking to him and then writing. Like I wrote I filled a whole journal like the last week of his life.
Wow.
So it really, for me, it was really like, it was never about one, like it was not intentional, as I said, and I don't have any training at all. Like I just write from my heart.
Yeah. And that's potent. That's the most potent work you can do when it comes from the heart. And that's what I was telling you about having these ripple effects, you know, like I remember scrolling and then seeing you and then reading your story and then just going, holy fuck. Like I had to take a moment to kind of absorb it and to really feel into it. But that sort of stuff, Mira, changes people. Like this is not like, I don't really take that lightly. Like this sort of work and the honesty that you're bringing to the table here changes people's lives. And that's something that I hope that you reflect on and you really, you know, celebrate those small wins, because it's powerful. So what I wanted to talk to you about too is those first initial moments with Brian when you did find out that Brian had brain cancer and bone cancer, was it?
No, so Brian had melanoma, which is skin cancer.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But it spread throughout his entire body, which is what melanoma frequently does.
Yeah.
And it often goes to the brain and the bones as well as a lot of other places.
Got you. Yeah. So when you first found out, what did you fall into shock? Did you fall into numbness? Were you in like despair? Were you in denial? What default emotion do you think you went into initially, and Brian, both of you, when you first heard that news?
Well, I think I definitely went into shock, for sure. And I think actually the shock lasted the full first year after he died as well.
Yeah.
But for sure, when he got the diagnosis, absolutely, I went into shock. I think that was sort of like if we're talking, I often think of emotions, especially in grief, in layers. Like in my writing, a lot of the time I use like imagery of layers, because I really do see grief as layered in multiple ways. Yeah. And then it's also helped me see the layers within everything, like within emotion, within life, within love, within all of these things. And so I think that like if we're talking layers, like there was a layer of shock that was kind of over top of everything, which didn't take away other things that were going on at the same time, but definitely numbed them slightly so that I could survive. So like, of course there was despair. It's not like that wasn't present. Like I think often we think of emotions as like, oh, well you go into shock and so therefore you're literally not feeling anything. And that was not my experience. Like I still was experiencing despair. I experienced a lot of fear. I remember identifying that one night early on. I was lying in bed and I started having panic attacks like after he was diagnosed, and I would lie in bed at night and I'd have a panic attack. And then I would be like, what's that feeling? And it was like a feeling that I guess I just wasn't super accustomed to.
Yeah.
And then I realized it was like fear, like deep, deep, deep fear, but not the fear of like, I'd never felt fear like this before. Like it was the fear that I feel is on such a deep level that it's like, it's a trauma kind of, right? It's a trauma sort of feeling. And it's a fear for your very existence of your entire world. Because in a moment like that, it's like your world blows open and you're like, oh, I thought I lived in this safe reality, but actually anything can happen. Like, this is the most shocking thing ever. Brian was literally the most healthy, the most health conscious person. And all of these, all of my ways of being, my belief system in the world, what I thought is possible, like, literally was crumbling. So there was a lot of that going on as well. And then also I sort of went into this mode of, I'm going to figure this out and I'm going to save him from this. I definitely went into that kind of caregiver mentality, which was really hard for a number of reasons, but primarily because he had such an aggressive cancer that there was never anything that even made him remotely feel better. Like, every day was significantly worse than the day before, and it was horrific. So I kind of took on this thing of like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, if there's anyone who can get us out of this, it's gonna be me, and I'm gonna figure this out for us. And then that did not work out at all.
I think it's a natural thing, from what I've witnessed, is wanting to save a situation and thinking that you can turn it around. I remember when my mom got diagnosed. That's right. It was all control. When my mom got diagnosed, I'm like, no way she's dying. That's not even an option. I'm going to fix this. And I felt like that was a pattern that has been playing out in my life, but especially with men, you know, like, I kind of look back on that, and think that, you know, like, men predominantly, and I'm kind of generalizing here, but instinctively want to fix things and don't want issues. They just want everything to be okay. I can definitely relate to you in that process with that. But with Brian and his psychological state with that, was he really into optimism, or was there a point where he was like, okay, we're going to beat this, we're not going to beat this? Where was he at initially when you were going through those initial stages?
Yeah, so, I mean, so first of all, I should kind of preface this all by saying that I think that there are lots of memories that are still missing for me from that time, because I was in such a state of trauma that I actually dissociated. Sometimes, because I've been asked this question a few times on different podcasts, and I'm always like, I don't think I actually remember all that much. And I think one of the things that you just, like, the question you just asked me about Brian's state throughout all of this, I think is part of what I've blocked out, because I find it really hard to answer this question. And I think that's part of it. But then also, I think also related is that he was already incredibly sick. So often when we think of cancer, we think of somebody getting a diagnosis because they have, you know, some kind of like strange persistent thing that they keep getting checked out, and then they get diagnosed with cancer and it's like, what? I feel totally fine. And then they do chemo, and that's when they start really, really feeling like shit. That was not our situation at all. So by the time that Brian was diagnosed, the cancer was already spread. He was in end stage of life by the time. That's how fast this cancer spread. He was diagnosed on a Thursday. Less than 48 hours later, he was in the ER because he had so much fluid buildup in his abdomen, which is now, it's called ascites. And now I know that that's like an end of life cancer symptom, is ascites. And then it has to be drained. It's like extra fluid around some of the organs. And he had been in so much pain because he hadn't been taking any real painkillers. And like, the first thing that the doctor said to me was, she was like, I cannot believe he has not been in the ER for pain management. Like, once they saw the extensiveness of the tumors in his spine and the bones of his shoulders and his hips. So he was A, in a great deal of pain. B, he also went into shock. And C, he already had 8 tumors in his brain by the time he was diagnosed as well.
Right.
So that had an effect too. And I don't know really to what extent. Like, he definitely was still himself, but I mean, it's all of those things combined, right? And then he went on the really, really strong pain medication. So like that impacts you too. And so it wasn't like we had this opportunity to have all of these really long, really in-depth, like, normal conversations that you have when you're not in the middle of the eye of the storm. We were always in the middle of the eye of the storm. So, but like, having said all of that, like, my memory right now of how Brian was that he was like 50 bajillion times calmer than me. I wouldn't say, like, I have some widow friends, because I've connected with a lot of widows since Brian died. And now I have some widow friends whose husbands were like super, super optimistic, like you said, like, we're just like not even willing to think about it. And we're like, I'm going to beat this. And there's, you know, nothing, it's just, it's going to happen. And we're not, even at the end, we're not willing to accept or really acknowledge that they were dying. And Brian wasn't like that. Like, he was definitely, it was like, he was just calm, and he accepted that this was happening. And he was just so loving. Like, he was just so appreciative of everything that anybody was doing. It's like, he just went into a state of like Zen. That's the only way I can really describe it. And I think he knew, like, I think he knew he was dying. And I think I did too, you know. Like, it was never like, I knew how bad it was. I knew how bad it was from the very beginning. It was almost like that night we were diagnosed, that was when the grieving began.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And when you described to me the eye of the storm, did you have a sense of like things were in fast forward, but they're also very slow through that process? Like, were things happening quick while staying slow to you?
I don't even, I feel like it was beyond even that. Like, it was more just like an altered reality where there was no time. That's more how I can describe it. Like, I was seriously in shock. And often I was just like, I don't even know what day it is. I don't know if that was a week ago or earlier today. Like, that kind of thing, you know.
And that's, and I feel like that's really normal for a human body, because it's like fight or flight. You've got cortisol running through your body. And I describe it, you know, because obviously when you hear news like that, I think a natural state is to go into shock a lot of the time. But like you said, there's layers to it. But your body, your body is kind of, for me, like, I kind of describe it to my friends when I was in the real heart of it, that, you know, it's like approaching a bear and your body is just kind of in shock, closing, and it's in survival. So it's just trying to survive and keep up with that whole process.
Totally.
And What I want to really get into you with is the subject around children and death and dying. I've kind of felt like I've got some silent criticism from family friends and people when, you know, because I was very open with my sons at the time of my mum getting diagnosed when she got really sick and dying. And, you know, for me, I was really honest. I gave age appropriate answers and really kind of, you could say not firm, but concrete answers to things, like really direct. So they really understood. And my sons were around mum when she was dying. They weren't there when she died, but afterwards when we mourned with her, in our family home for 3 days, they were around her dead body, and all that. What's your take on that? Because I find it's really, I find it quite normal for my side of things and the process of dying. But what's your thoughts with children and, you know, teenagers, all that, for people who are listening, with someone who's dying and death?
Yeah, I actually just published a piece on this earlier this week, and it's on this exact topic. It's called The Invisible Mourner.
Right.
And then the subheading is My Daughter is Grieving, but Nobody Wants to Talk About It, or something like that. And it's related to what you're saying. It's more about, for me, it's more about the fact that people don't want to acknowledge her grief. Like, that is more what bothers me, but also for sure around the actual dying process as well. I completely agree with you. Like I mean, I'm so grateful that I decided to include Davita in that process when Brian was dying, because I don't even know, sometimes I wonder how I made decisions like that, because it was just, it was such a horrible, horrible, horrible time. And it was so quick. And I was just in such despair and shock and all those other things we just talked about, that I sometimes wonder, I'm like, how did I make that decision? But I think sometimes in those states, you just make these decisions that feel so intuitively right. Mm. And you're just sort of stripped into this state where, like, I almost feel like people say, you know, don't make any big decisions within the first year after a huge loss, a huge traumatic loss. I almost feel like, because I didn't really, and sometimes I feel like I should have, like, right. I was in this really clear-headed, this is not advice for anybody who's going through a traumatic loss, but it's something I have thought about, like, maybe that conventional wisdom isn't true, because, you know, that's a good example of something where I was just like, I have such a strong, intuitive, stripped down feeling right now that I want my daughter to be part of this. I had no time to do research. I couldn't consult with anybody. You know, I just sort of was, I didn't know anyone who'd ever gone through something like this. And I was just like, I want her to be there. Mm. Like, I just decided one day I want her to be there. And so she started coming to the hospital every day. And yeah, I mean, and it was unfortunate because I really wanted Brian to die at home, but he couldn't, because he had certain levels, his potassium level and his calcium level were like really dangerously out of whack. So we had to be hospitalized to have those fixed. And then in the meantime, he had to have another one of those ascites drains, because he had to have that every week. And by the time he had that done, they said that he was so weak, he might die in the ambulance going home. And I didn't want to take that risk. Wow, so yeah. I ended up getting my sister to go to our apartment, and she brought like all of these things from our apartment to the hospital. And I set up the hospital room like it was a room in our home. And there was like a note on the door that said, you know, for the nurses and everyone just not to come in at all, and unless they had to administer pain meds. Yeah. And they just trusted me that I would, like, they kind of trusted, they just, I'm an occupational therapist too. So I think they kind of gave me a little bit more leeway. So we really were able to have our own space with our music and our energy and everything. And they literally just tiptoed in, gave them the pain meds and tiptoed out. And right. That was it. Mm-hmm. So it was, that was really great. But I'm getting off topic now. You asked me about the kid thing. So yes, I really feel like it's really important for kids to be involved in the whole process of death, dying, but grief too. Mm. And the grief, I think, is the part of it that's often forgotten about, because kids don't grieve in the way that we as adults grieve. And so we often see them playing and being happy, and we're like, oh, you know, they're fine. Like a minute after I told Davita that Brian had died, she was playing. As if I hadn't just told her that, like, this thing that's going to impact her life in such a huge way forever, and that she's going to be grieving for, you know, potentially 80 years, you know, depending on how long she lives, she's going to be grieving this loss. And, but you could never tell. So I think because kids grieve in this different way, we don't often acknowledge it, understand it. It's really easy. And especially because we don't want to think of kids grieving, because it's so hard. I mean, nobody wants to think of anyone grieving, which is why grief is so not normalized and in our society,
push to the corner.
We just don't. Yeah. We don't even want to, it's too hard for us to even acknowledge that. And so for kids, it's like that times 1,000, right? We don't want to think about little kids grieving, because it's so sad to think about. So, this is what the piece that I just wrote is about, but just to really get back to what you actually asked me, I think that death is just as natural a process as birth. The two are so similar from my perspective, and they're really, really magical, both of them, I think. And there was a real, I mean, to be witness, I mean, Davita was not there when he actually died. I was alone with him when he actually died, which was really good. I'm so glad that it happened that way, because I didn't have to be like a mom too in that moment. I could just be just be with him. But she was there like the earlier, like a few hours before he died, when he was, you know, very close to death. And it just felt right, you know, it just felt natural and right. And it felt like I didn't want to take that experience away from her, because I think that that's going to be a really pivotal experience for her life. And she's, I mean, this is what her life is. This is what it, you know, so we might as well really experience it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're practicing honesty and not deceit. And I think in those moments when I had to choose that, I was like, I don't want to keep anything from my sons. I know this is the most, you can't get a most wholesome truth in life than death in my eyes, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to hide them from that, you know? And I think that a lot of parents, when they have the image of death and that process, depending, you know, it's pretty subjective, but, they want to protect their kids, you know, they don't want to tell them the truth, and be there, but it's so beneficial. And I know that, you know, like my boys now, you know, you ask Eli, you say, hey, where's Nana Jules? And he'll point to his heart. He'll say, in my heart, in my third eye. And she lives in the moon and the stars. Like he talks about her a lot and talks to her a lot. Or if he sees a significant sign in his life, like a butterfly coming close to him, he'll acknowledge that, hey, that's a sign from Nana Jules. And I think that's just so profound.
Totally.
And having that at that age is such a head start in life, as crazy it probably might sound. I just think it's a head start. It's such a rite of passion. And if you,
like, I'm sure people are listening to this and being like, head start, what are you talking about? But I actually do know what you mean. Like, but doesn't that sound ridiculous when you take yourself out of the context of having gone through a significant death? Like, I think people who have not yet would be like, what is he talking about?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
that's my greatest fear, would be for my, you know, my mom to die or my partner to die. Like, right? They don't think of it that way, but I totally get what you mean. I mean, there's just so much, you can't go through something like that, really go through it, really experience it and not gain some wisdom. Like, you just can't, you can't. It's not because like you or I are in any way like more incredible or anything. It's like, it's experience. When you go through something like that, you just change. You just, you can't help but change.
And it's like, it's like a switch. I say to people a lot, like, once you know death, you can't unknow it. There's no going back. Like, I studied a lot about death prior to really having someone close to me die. And before that, I got it, you know, I understood it. But until you go through it, it's just like, for me, it was just like a switch that just got turned on, and that switch doesn't get turned off anymore. You just don't go back to the normal way of, oh, I don't know.
For sure.
But when people listen to it, it might sound crazy. It might sound absurd. People that have really embodied that practice and been there and really been stripped completely understand that, that statement. But it's really interesting that you talk about how you set that room up for Brian and the practice of ritual, and how, for me, ritual is a real transition and a bridge to a lot of things. For me, it's a bridge to my stillness. It gives me an opportunity to get to a place of being sacred. And there's so many rituals throughout the world, but I was so interested. Man, I've been going off subject quickly, but I've been so interested in this podcast. Last night I couldn't even sleep, and usually I don't write anything down, but I've got so many questions. I was like last night, I'm like, holy shit, I'm so excited about talking to Mira. I could just hear people, you know, if someone heard that, they're thinking, man, that guy, he loves talking about it. But the process of ritual, and for you, and setting up that room, how it came so instinctive to you. Can you bring me through that process, and actually, where do you think that came from in you? Because
I do know. Okay. I was going to say, I have no idea. And then I was like, wait, I do know. Okay. Sorry. Continue.
Because you prior to that moment, correct me if I'm wrong, but did you know much about ritual? Had you practiced ritual? because it seemed like from what I read your blog, you know, my jaw was on the ground. It was like so appropriate, so profound, so transformational in the things that you set up for Brian. And what a privilege that is to create that space, you know, mm-hmm. for him. That's so special.
Totally. Mira.
You know, like that room could have been sterile. It could have been cold, you know what I mean? But you set that up for him to transition.
Yeah.
So can you unpack that?
Yeah, for sure. I was, I have so much to say on this, but, this is kind of like a bit of a joke before I get into seriously answering the question, but it was kind of like an inside, you know, thing between Brian and I, where like, I've always cared so much about, you know, the way a space is, the vibe, the warmth, you know, all of that. And I love like decorating a space like that in a way that's just creates a certain energy is one of my favorite things to do. And Brian was always like, you know, we'd have dinner parties and stuff, and he'd be like, okay, so I'm going to, you know, organize all the food, cook everything, do everything. You're just going to do your thing with the space that you like to do. And that was like my little tiny rule that I had. And then he did everything else. And like, you know, he would often make fun of me for how much I cared about that kind of thing. And like, it didn't really actually, I don't think he really cared that much about stuff like that. So I often wonder now, I'm like, did he even care? Like, people are always like, wow, you did this amazing service for him, you know, creating such a beautiful space. And I'm like, it was for me. Like, I don't know if he even noticed. Maybe he did. He probably noticed the energy shift that I felt. Mm. And he probably noticed, like, there were certain things he definitely could notice. Like, I changed the lighting. Like, I put our salt crystal lamps in there instead of, you know, the hospital lighting. Like, that's obviously a huge, amazing difference. Mm. For me, that's, like, lighting is everything.
Yeah.
And then I had like really like important pictures that I knew were really meaningful to him, like right in front of him. So he could like look at them really every time he opened his eyes. So those were the things he probably really noticed. And then the music, like Brian was a musician. So, but in answer to your question of how I thought of it, I really think it was inspired by what Brian did for me for my birth. Because, right. And I don't even know if that was intentional or if it was, I don't know if I made the connection. I can't remember if I made the connection at the time or later, but I think at least part of me must have made the connection at the time, because I chose to play the birth playlist that we had made for Davida's birth while Brian was dying.
Right.
So obviously I somehow was making that connection in my mind because I thought to choose that playlist. But like when I was going to be giving birth, Brian, I hadn't really, so I was kind of funny when I gave birth. I planned for a home birth, but I didn't want to say that that's what I was doing, because I just wanted to keep it open in case, you know, things started up and I was just like, actually, no, I wanted to leave it open to whatever I felt, but I planned for a home birth. And Brian surprised me by setting up the room. Like one day when I was at work or something, he set up the room where the birth pool was with all of these things. And again, it was so meaningful because he didn't really give a shit about that stuff, but he knew that it meant something to me. So he really created this beautiful space with all of these little, you know, wooden sculptures that I'd gotten on my travels. And it was all like feminine kind of vibe. Like I have lots of paintings that I've gotten in different places that are, you know, mama baby paintings or pregnancy or strong female, strong femininity stuff. And it was all that. And then the lamps and the candles and everything, like it was so sweet. And so I think that part of me was thinking of that. And it was almost like I used what he had done for me as my inspiration for what I did for him. And I've always felt like ritual is really important to me. I think it might partly be like in my genetics deeply, because I'm Jewish and Jews are all about ritual. Like Judaism is all about ritual. It's like not really as much about what you say, you know, like, it's one of those religions where it really is all about what you do, and you're supposed to do these specific things. And I'm not religiously Jewish, like, I don't practice, but you know, I feel like those things are somewhere deep inside of me, because ritual itself as just a thing in general has always been something that's been really important to me. Like, it's always been something that, like you said, like, that calms me, that I really do use ritual as a tool, and I always, always have. And so did Brian. Like, that was something that was really important to both of us.
Yeah. 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 That's, it's definitely the bridge, you know, without me discovering ritual, I don't believe that I'd be the person I am today. You know, I used to get really sick every 3 months, it's because I was so busy with work and these imaginary goals, you know, getting acknowledged by my community. And, you know, if I had X, Y, and Z, then that's, you know, that for me was making it. But ritual gave me the tools, like you said, to really create that stillness and, you know, be here right now with life. And it's just so soothing for me. We kind of touched a little bit on birth and death, which is really, really potent. And there's so many similarities from what I had, you know, I've witnessed two births, and then obviously witnessing my mum's death. And for me, there's kind of my beliefs, there's no deaths. There's the birth of giving birth to a child, and then when someone dies, they're birthing their soul. That's the kind of way I look at it. And the similarities that I kind of witnessed through those processes of witnessing Laura give birth was, and mum dying, was the process of them slowly going in, you know, when, you know, they weren't interested in the outside world, friends. They would slowly come in, and then, you know, it'd be me and her, and then eventually it'd just be Laura. And in my mum's case, you know, the community was no longer, you know, really important. A friend, and then it came down to her friends, and then it came down to her family, and then it came down to my dad. And then eventually she went right in with herself to be able to birth that. But what's your take on birth and death and the similarities there?
That was something that I had been with Brian when his dad was dying.
Right.
So his dad died a little less than 3 years before he did, and I wasn't there when he actually the moment he died, but I was there maybe like 2 hours before. I had to leave to take Davida home because she was just a baby, but I was there for, you know, throughout that process as well. And that was, and I had just given birth about 4 months less than no about 4 months before,
right?
So it was really fresh in my mind, you know. And so I kept, like, I could not, the whole time Brian's dad was dying, I was just like, is this just because I just gave birth, or is this really a thing? Like, is anyone else noticing how similar these things are? Like, it was wild. Like, I was just like, the energy was the same. So okay, there's so many things. Like, I am the time thing was similar, like the way that labor will sort of speed up and then slow down, and then sort of, a lot will happen, and it's like, oh, things are progressing, and then it's like, oh no, we've stalled again. Like, that was sort of, we've stalled again. Like, that's kind of the way it felt as well when Brian's dad was dying, and then again when Brian was dying. Like, it was sort of this, you know, and this really teaches you this feeling of like, we can't control this process. Like, we can manage the pain, we can control the pain, all of these things, but like, death will happen on its own schedule. And that's how it felt with my birth as well, like the same sort of feeling of time ebbing and flowing. So that was one thing. And then the energy, really, like, there was both, it just, you feel like there's, it's so hard to even describe, but it's this feeling of the way that I literally see it is like the world cracking open for a time. And it's like, you can see or feel something beyond what you feel typically in the day to day. And it's almost, you can't, I mean, you can no longer wonder, you know, whether there's anything else. For me, it was like in those moments, I then just knew. I was like, well, I felt it, so it's true. And it felt like it was, there's like the aftershock and the before shock too. Like I felt, even with my birth, I felt the same way, where it was like for days afterwards, I felt like I was still able to sort of touch that world, but it was slowly kind of dissipating again. And it was the same with when Brian died. Like even right after he died, I felt like, you know, I was just with him for a while. And you're so lucky that you got like 3 full days with your mom, or I think you said 3 days. That's amazing. Like with Brian, I got, I had like 1 full hour before I told anybody that he had died. So I just didn't tell any of the hospital staff, and I just stayed with him for an hour. And I mean, that time was sacred. Like I felt like this similar sort of feeling as I felt right after Davida was born. Like it was a similar feeling in me, a similar feeling in the air, in the space. You know, it was, there was just undeniably, they were so similar.
So similar. Yeah. I kind of felt like when I experienced it, it was like me coming out of water, taking a breath. And it was like this new world from when the boys came into the world and my mum passed. There was this really, it was odd stillness. Like it was just, but it was so beautiful and so,
yeah,
you're just in awe of life. It's just like I that's what I remember when mum died. I'm like, fuck, this feels like birth. Like that, those moments when we were around her and she left, I was like, there's that stillness and that, I can't describe it. I can't put a word on.
I know, I'm having trouble describing it too.
That feeling, it's kind of like you're in awe, but you're trying to keep up with how special that moment is. But there's so many other emotions that attach to that.
Exactly. That's what I was just going to say. Yeah.
It's like, you can't, it's really difficult. So for anyone who's listening, it's just kind of like, it's really difficult. Maybe you can explain it a bit better, but I can't put words on that.
Well, for me, what I was going to add, because I feel like we've gotten into this sort of realm of like, death is beautiful, which I do believe. Like I have a whole piece that I wrote called "Is Beautiful Death" that's about this. But also I think that it's like not to be confused with the lack of complete despair. Like I mean, I don't know like the story of your mom, or if like it sounds like it was pretty tragic from like the way that you talk about it. And like, I certainly feel like Brian's death was like a huge tragedy in all of our lives. But I think that moment was sort of the first moment that I understood this connection between grief and love and pain and beauty, like those two, how those things actually coexist and are the same thing. And if you go like far enough along the spectrum in one direction, you reach the other, right? Like, that's, right. And so I think that was sort of the first, those moments when Brian died, where I did feel that stillness. I did feel that beauty. I mean, I was like in awe, like you said, all of those things. And I was also like losing my fucking mind. Like my life had just blown apart. I was like, I can't go on without this person. Like this person is my soulmate. Like I am torn open. I'm going to die too. I can't survive this. Like all of those things, right, are coexisting at the same time. So it's not like, oh, it was this beautiful, amazing thing, and therefore I wasn't, you know, totally, completely in despair and agony, because I was. But also like strangely calm. I was also strangely calm. It's weird when I think about it. Like I'm just like, whoa. How, but it's because it is so soft and beautiful and slow, and even though it was also quick, you know.
that was the feeling of it being fast, like fast forwarded, but being so slow. Like when you're talking about the eye of the storm, it kind of brought back a lot of memories for me, because I was like, God, I remember that so vividly. It went so fast, but it was in like slow-mo. I'm like,
yeah, you're like right, actually.
It's like all these worlds, you know, you've got all these worlds coming into one. So it's not like you said, it's not just like you sit there and go, oh, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And then it's all, you know, daisies and flowers and life's great. You've just witnessed your husband die. You've just witnessed your mother die. So you've just, so many crazy emotions come into play.
Yeah.
But there's magic. There's complete magic in that. What are some of the ways, like if someone's listening right now who's lost, been in a similar situation to you or going through something similar, what are some of the ways that you found has been really helpful to support you physically? You know, like is there anything that you can kind of touch on that you feel like that's really helped you through your grief? Because there's so much physical repercussions with such a strong emotion and layers that your body, you know, I've just found like I've actually become a lot healthier since my mom's death, but I've had to work a lot harder to look after me because I'm just, you know, on a daily basis, I'm great one second. And then holy shit, I'm like, I'm feeling really crap. And then I'm kind of at a place of joy. Like I'm kind of touching at a place of joy right now, but yeah. What are some of the things that kind of worked for you?
Yeah. How long has it been since your mom died?
She died, it's going on a year on the 7th of Feb.
Okay, so you're coming up to the year, yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. I found that was a pretty intense time for sure, like leading up to that 1 year. But the physical health thing is a huge piece, and I'm really glad you brought it up because I think that I still have so far to go in that area. Like I think with this, the magnitude of the type of loss and the type of grief that I've experienced and just how it's been so earth shattering, there's been not a lot of space for any of that sort of attention to physical health. But in the moments when I have been able to tend to my physical body, I can see glimmers of what you're talking about in terms of like becoming healthier, like you said, because I can see how once you've experienced such a falling apart and once you know sort of how bad things can feel, then there's more of a desire to actually feel better and to do things that will help you feel better. So I can sort of see how that, and I have experienced glimmers of that. So for me, for the first year after Brian died, I think the number one thing for me in terms of like every sort of spiritual, emotional, physical health, everything was just to give myself grace. So I was always a very health conscious person, and so was Brian. And we always had very healthy, just a very healthy way of living and just our daily practices. So I think that definitely helped me just because I had a sort of a baseline of health. But I also, my, like I mentioned earlier in the interview, like my perception of health and the importance of valuing your health and all of that was really shifted in a really, really scary way when Brian died, because it was like my whole value system was under attack. Because all of a sudden I was like, well, does it even make a fucking difference what I do? Like I Brian meditated and look what happened to him. Brian ate super healthy and look what happened to him. Like screw all of this, you know? So there was a big part of me that was, and actually I think like for a really long time, I didn't really have a very strong will to live. Like, and I think it's important in grief to sort of make the distinction between like being suicidal, which I wasn't, and not having a will to live, which I was. And a lot of that first year, especially. And so just cause it was so painful to live. So I was like, why would I want to keep doing this? This is so painful. And when you're in it and you feel like it's never going to end, it's like, well, you know, how am I, it is never going to end. And you hear that all the time too. Right. And that is true, but it changes and it's not as raw and as sharp and as painful as it was at the beginning anymore. Although in moments it still is, but mm-hmm. not to the same extent and not as much as it was before. And it's not like that, like for the first little while, it was like there was no reprieve at all, you know, like I was just constantly feeling so in, like I was in so much heart pain, and I just couldn't even, yeah, I didn't even have the will to, you know, like one of the things I hated the most in the first year was when friends who hadn't been through that type of a traumatic loss would say things like, oh, Mira, just practice some self-care, you know, like you should take a bath, you should take care of yourself. And it was so frustrating to me because I was like, I'm the queen of self-care. Like literally I was always the person who I was so on top of my self-care. And both of Brian and I, like we were just like that. And that was really important to us. And it just made me feel like people didn't understand what it's actually like to go through something this hard, and how, when you don't even have the motivation to do anything like that, because you literally think nothing's going to make a difference. And then also things that used to make my physical body feel better, like baths, like meditation, like long walks, like those types of things were really hard for me, because those were the times when I was left to my own devices to like think about how much I miss Brian, to let the grief come. And it was so painful. So I was like, those things were not serving me in the way that they were. So anyways, I think one of the most important things when you go through really traumatic loss like this is just like, give yourself grace and don't put any pressure on yourself for the first year, because those things do naturally creep back in. But for me, like with my personality, I'll put a lot of pressure on myself. So if I'm like, I'm going to do yoga every day, then if I don't, then I feel even more guilty, or like, I'm not. And I mean, there, I just find like I cannot have the same expectations of myself as I used to have before. And slowly yet surely those things are coming back in. Like I'm wanting more to actually stretch my body, to do yoga, to take walks, to take like those things are coming back. And I can see what you were saying. Like I do have these moments when I'm like, oh my God, I just did yoga every day for a week and I actually do feel better. And I like, that is so rewarding when you've experienced such depth of pain and suffering, you know? So it's almost like I'm more motivated to do those things in certain moments. I'm still figuring it out though. Honestly, I'm still figuring it out. I still go through huge periods of time when I just don't want to do anything still.
But I think we're always figuring it out, right? It's do we ever come to a point of going, oh, I've just got a grasp of everything. I know this, that, and the other. I think it's ever evolving, right? Like it's kind of a stamp that you always have. It's like, yes, it will transform. And like you said, it won't be as sharp and as painful, but that's there for life, I feel.
For sure.
You know, it's not like it's, you know, going to wake up one day and go, well, you know, that's disappeared. That kind of weird to kind of think about, but do you feel like when people are witnessing someone grieve, do you feel like, and this is coming from my own experience, but do you feel like people either like want to take energy or give you energy? It's like, sometimes I notice people when they come to me and they're either want to just acknowledge, what's happened, which is really beautiful. But sometimes, and more of these times, is when people come up and kind of want to, in some unconscious way, extract energy by going, you know, have you tried this? Have you done this? Have you, you know, this is, you know, trying to solve a problem. But there's an underlying thing that's happening that I feel like I walk away and go, hey, maybe I need to kind of, you know, review my boundaries. And what does
interesting.
And what does that look like? Because I just know that at my mum's ceremony, some people would come up, embrace me, look me in the eye, and that was it. And that was enough. And some other people would come up and there'd be story attached to their personal intentions. So something like that. Have you experienced anything similar?
Yeah, I'm super interested in what you're saying. So wait, before I answer, I just want to understand. So when you say extract energy, like, what do you mean by that exactly?
Like I,
what,
I mean that they come with a set of intentions that they might not be conscious of, but it's more about, it's more about them getting something off their chest that they might not have dealt with. Or
and
I don't think it is, you know, I don't think they come up and intentionally do that.
Totally.
But sometimes I get into conversations and I'm not the one talking. I'm like, hang on a second. Maybe, you know, maybe you need to seek a tool to unload that pain for yourself, because I'm not that person. Just because, you know, it's just, but what I've learned is, and it's shone a lot of light on, is that, hey, I need to review my boundaries. And, and review them and enforce them in a very respectful way of going, hey, I can't do that to you right now. I can't have that conversation. Thanks for acknowledging, you know, my grief and all that, but you know, your story, or, you know, however I want to put it, but I feel like having, you know, healthy boundaries around that, it's probably more, you know, a better for all parties. But yeah,
that is what I thought you meant. Okay. Yeah. Yes. I've definitely experienced that. And I've thought a lot about it too. And I find it so fascinating. Like, why do people do that? Because it definitely happens to me too. And I think for me, sometimes I wonder if it's partly like, because I write about grief so openly and so vulnerably, and a lot of people in my life, I think, then feel like, I'm a safe person to talk to about their unprocessed grief in other areas of their life that they've never really been able to talk with anybody about, because grief is so taboo in our society. And so then they'll talk. So I often wonder if it happens even more to me, because I'm now seen as this person who's not only gone through this huge loss, but also is openly sharing about it. So I'm obviously comfortable holding space for those types of conversations, and I'm open to talking about grief and loss. So, but it's interesting that like you're experiencing this. I mean, obviously you're also, because you've started this podcast and you are, you know, writing and sharing about grief and death as well. So perhaps that's part of it for you too. But I wonder if it happens to everybody who goes through a big loss, you know, as much as it's happening to us. But anyways, aside from that, like the way I think of it is, it's like, when you go through this huge, I've often thought of this image of myself as this like lighthouse. So it's like when you go through this really huge thing, this huge loss, this huge grief, it's like you're this lighthouse of grief. Mm. And all of these people around you who have all of this unprocessed grief, or not even, I shouldn't even necessarily say unprocessed necessarily, but just grief unexpressed, like that they don't know where to talk about and who to talk about with. And it's just, but it's there, because grief is as present as love for all of us. They're this two sides of the same coin. So it's there within people. And then they see this lighthouse of grief, me or you, and it's like, oh my gosh, there's somebody who I can share this with. But actually, that's not appropriate. And if we lived in a society with the appropriate amount of grief conversation and dialogue, like, have you heard of the ring theory?
No, I haven't. Ever? No.
It's super interesting. It's like, it's this theory in grief where it's like, I describe it properly, but it's like, there's a dot in the middle and then there's rings all around the dot. And so the dot in the middle is like the person who's most affected by a traumatic loss, a traumatic event, a death. So like in this situation of Brian, that would be me, like I'm in the center. Yeah. And then there's a ring around me of like our closest family. And then there's a ring around that of our closest friends. And then there's a ring around that of extended family. And then a ring around that of, you know, more distant friends and acquaintances and outward and outward and outward. And the idea is that when you're in the middle, you can talk about your experience and what you're going through and how hard it is and how painful it is. And you can be angry and all of that to the layers, any of the layers beyond you. That's like the one benefit of being the person in the middle. And then within every other layer, you can do that outwards, but all you do inwards is support.
Right.
So you don't put your own shit, your own grief, your own whatever this is triggering within you. You don't put that inwards. You only put that outwards, and then you only put the support inwards.
Yeah.
And that, I feel like that's the way that it should be in a healthy society with a healthy amount of grief dialogue and conversation and knowledge and education and all of that. Like that's how a society should work, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, since we're touching on this subject, I think that what we're talking about here needs to be actually taught in schools. You know,
totally.
I
want to teach this in schools. Like, I actually do. I want to approach my daughter's principal. I'd be like, can I teach the kids about grief? Because, like, it's such, important.
It's such, it's an inevitable part of life. Like, regardless of what's going to happen, you're going to die, someone else is going to die, and there's no changing that, you know? So why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
It makes complete sense to me that you'd have an education system in schools where they're teaching it in a soft way, in an approachable way, where kids are, and it's all about, it's not necessarily about creating skills or being, you know, the best griever or anything like that, but it's been familiar with the subject. Mm-hmm. Because right now it's like, I remember when I first started my page, some of my friends called me and go, fuck, Brent, all that stuff you're doing is so intense.
Yeah.
So intense. Yeah. Like I don't want to, like, I don't even go near it. I'm, I don't want to engage with it. I'm scared to even like it. you know, and I said to them, I said, well, can I offer you my perspective? And maybe you need to re-look at your relationship to it. Because I said, if that's hard to process, if that's hard to digest, then what's going to happen when you're in a situation of dying? If you are, mm-hmm. you know, or your
mother. Because we're all gonna be there one day. Like,
we're gonna be there,
right?
You know, it's either gonna be expected or sudden. So if you're looking at an Instagram page that you think, holy shit, and you want to run the other way, then what's going to happen when, you know, the main event happens, when it's in, mm-hmm. when it's in your shoes? But it's so taboo. It's so like,
I know.
Let's not talk about this, Mira. Let's just shove it in a corner. Let's wrap it up. Let's hide it. Let's put it in the dark and let's deal with it when we have to deal with it. And it's something that's motivated me, and I'm sure to hell that it's motivated you to have these conversations. What we're doing right now is to bring it out of the dark.
Totally.
And the dark is not so dark, you know. It's not like, oh, dark is evil. We're thinking of the Grim Reaper, all this crazy evil shit. There's a lot of life in the dark. Babies get born in the dark. Seeds germinate in the dark. There's life in the dark. Is it similar in Canada? Like, is it do you think it's is it the same as like in Australia here? Like, is it the same kind of thing?
You like mean this obsession with like lightness and positivity and life and avoidance of death and all
yeah,
of that?
Yeah, like avoidance. Like,
yeah, totally.
Hit the road in the opposite direction and let's speed off.
Totally. I feel like all Western cultures are like that. Like, I think that's pretty much across the board. I think it's doing us a huge disservice. Sorry, go ahead.
So, do you think it stems from like a lack of culture in the Western world? Like, I know for Australia, we used to have practices with the Indigenous where it used to be called death and sorry business, where they used to have ceremony over weeks. Everyone was involved. The whole process was very healing and transformational. Where here, you know, you get diagnosed, you're in a hospital, you're at a funeral, you're at the wake, and usually the wake's fueled with alcohol and whatever else. Mm-hmm. Let's service our, you know, let's numb, let's not feel, let's numb.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, do you think it's a lack of culture? Where do you think that comes from? Do you think it's just us turning our back on death?
Gosh, I don't know where. Yeah, probably. I mean, that makes sense to me. I think that it's definitely a fear of it, and a fear of discomfort, and a fear of, you know, I guess addressing our own mortality. It seems to me like just a disconnection. I think it's related to our disconnection from Mother Earth, from this planet that we live on. Like, I think all of those, it's capitalism, like it's all of those things connected. Yeah. I think grief is political, grief is spiritual grief is everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's just sort of this, it just shows me how disconnected we are from life in a lot of ways. Mm. And certainly from how we treat this planet that we're so lucky to live on. And, right. you know, all of the fallout that we see from that. Like, I think all of those things are very, very connected. And also one other thing I wanted to say about what you were saying, because I loved what you were saying about, like, we go into the situation sort of, I think you said, unprepared for the main event. I love that. And I think that that is so absolutely true. And then, like, for me, I just felt like I was pushed into the situation and I needed to sort of just improvise and figure it out as I was going. And I think that I was able to do that in a way. I've always been a little bit maybe more comfortable holding space for hard things. Like, I think that's kind of lucky for me, was already kind of a part of who I am. But what I found really hard is then you as the griever, you're kind of, you emerge, you know, after the funeral or whatever, and you're like, oh, now I need to teach all of these people around me how to deal with what's going on. And it falls on the griever to then take on that load of educating and teaching, because nobody else knows that. So how great would it be if we had a sort of a base knowledge? Like, I think teaching these things in school is an amazing idea. Because if we all just sort of had a little bit more comfort, a little bit more understanding, I think that it would just take such a burden off of the griever to then have to take all of that on top of everything else. And I think in a lot of these, a lot of other cultures where there is more of a structure in place for what happens when there is a death, and it isn't something that everybody just shies away from and ignores and like numbs out and gets drunk and then, oh, the funeral's over and we wipe our hands clean and you're back at work 3 days later in the United States of America. I know that that's what it is. And it's like, I'm sure it's similar in Canada. Like, I was self-employed, so I never had to deal with like a boss forcing me to go back to work, but I'm pretty sure it's probably very similar in Canada as it is in the United States. And I think like in a lot of other cultures where there is more of like a system in place of what, how people just know sort of what to do when there's a death, and they're, it's not just shunned and turned away from, they're probably, it probably is easier on the grievers. Like, I would imagine that that burden then would be taken off the grievers in a way. I don't know this for sure, but it's just sort of, you know, I wonder if there, if that used to be the way it was, or in other cultures today still is the way it is. I don't know that much about like other cultures and how they deal with death, to be honest.
Look,
you probably know more than I do, because you actually studied death and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know a whole bunch, because there's so much involved in
sure,
and all that. But I know this. I know that did it a lot better than what we're doing it. You know, and I know in Australia it's money driven. It's like, hey, you know, it's really sneaky with these funeral directors, is they kind of swoop in at such a vulnerable state, and all people want to do is sort the situation out, you know. Yes, like, let's organize a funeral, yes, coffin, $5,000 for the coffin, whatever. But I know that it's really sneaky, and when I started to learn about it, that's kind of one of the things that kind of really sparked me, was like, fuck them for swooping in on such vulnerable people and taking, you know, really taking, subtracting like a lot of their emotional processes, but also financially, you know, we're starving them of that. And can you hear that screaming right now?
Yeah, is that one of your children screaming?
Just anyone who's tuned in, they can't see the visuals. Everyone's okay on this end. It's just my just running around screaming. But yeah, funeral directors here, that they lure you in to spending money, you know, and no affordable options. So when I did a lot of studies, some of it was around alternative way of doing death and what that looks like. You know, you can bring someone home to die. You can buy affordable options. You can buy, make your own coffin. I made my mum's coffin, you know, and instead of, you know, spending $2,000-$4,000 on it, it cost me $280. And
oh, wow.
And that process for me was incredible. But it's just, you know, the market here, I think it's Invocare. The Australian market's dominated by Invocare. It's like 80% of the market where they pretty much have the access to people in those situations. So I feel like having more education, people being more familiar with death and knowing their options around that is a good start. But I also think too, ceremony is a huge, huge step in the healing process for people. If you can do a somewhat honorable ceremony for you and for the person who's passed and their wishes, it can really save you a lot of therapy, I think. You know, because
it feels really nice.
You know, if you were to ask 100 people how many good funerals they've been to, I reckon 90 would say they've mostly been to bad funerals, but they've walked
Brian's
out.
Brian's funeral was so good. It was so good.
Tell me
it
about
was amazing.
That. Tell me
yeah.
about
I don't want to interrupt you though. You can
This is no structure to this. That was number 16 question. Brian's funeral.
Oh my god. So as you were talking, there were like 10 different times that I wanted to interrupt you, but I held off. Because I was like, oh yeah, I have something to say about that. I'm trying really hard to interrupt less. Especially
free.
When it's about death.
Yeah, no, feel free. But I do appreciate, you know, giving space for that voice. But no, please talk into Brian's ceremony.
Okay. It was awesome. It was horrible as well, obviously, but I just did exactly what I wanted to do. And I was so lucky that everybody let me do exactly what I wanted to do. Like nobody else, basically everyone was just like, Mira's going to want to plan it and she's going to know what Brian would have wanted best. And we're just going to let her plan it. Like that was it sort of. So, cause a lot of the time there's issues within the family, right? Of people wanting different things. Like that's a really common stress that can come up for a lot of people after a death.
Yeah.
So I was so fortunate that that was not part of my story as well. But I just wanted to say one other funny thing, which, cause you were talking about the funeral directors. I remember after Brian died, like I didn't want to have to deal with the funeral director at all. I thought I was under the assumption that like we could just, you know, cremate him and then I could scatter his ashes everywhere in nature that I wanted and I could just plan my own thing and I didn't even have to deal with the funeral director. But then I realized, no, actually you have to. I don't know if it's the same in Australia, but like even if you're doing cremation, even if you're not having a funeral at a funeral home or anything like that, you need to contact a funeral director. You need to pay them like, the $5,000 or whatever for them to pick up the body, identify it, bring it to the crematorium and do all of that. Like there, it's like you literally, well, at least to me in my state of, you know, I didn't have any time to plan. I didn't know anything beforehand.
Yeah.
Like pretty much that was the only option that was presented to me. So that's what I had to do. And I remember going in to this funeral director and he was like, so sleazy. And like, he came up and I was just like, okay, this is what I literally did not want to have to deal with you, but I've learned that I do have to. This is all I want. So, you know, whatever the cheapest option is, I am doing this all myself, totally grassroots. I'm just using you for like the thing I need to use you for. Mm. And then he like gave me the thing and it was, you know, $5,600 or something. And I remember just looking up at him as I was about to sign and being like, good business to be in, eh? And he was just like, yeah, it is. And like smiled at me. What? And I was like, this is the most sleazy situation. Huh. I literally just lost like the love of my life. You are disgusting. Like I was just, oh my God, it was horrendous. Yeah. It was horrendous. And like, then I had to view Brian's body at that guy's funeral home, even though I'd been with him when he died.
Yeah.
For some reason, I still needed to go like view. Anyways, blah, 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 blah. So that guy, I totally agree with you like that. And apparently there's this, I've been reading recently, there's this thing that's kind of getting more popular in Canada and the United States right now where you can do, it's called like a green burial. And you know, there's these different companies popping up where you can bury somebody in a way that is like re-nourishing for our planet.
Right.
And because apparently like the process of both burial and cremation is really bad
for the environment,
for the planet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I've been learning about this a little bit recently. I don't know much about it, but it sounds like a really cool idea.
Mm. No, it is. Without a doubt it is. It's like, and you even get ones that are, I think it's called the pod deaths or something like that, where you can get under a tree. Yeah. Like, how awesome is that? Like,
yeah, like that's, and it sucks because like Brian would have totally wanted that. And I just never even knew that it was a thing back then. But anyways.
An option. But I think like in Australia, legally you don't need a funeral director. And what I will say is that there's a huge difference between policy and the law. And funeral directors bang on about policy and it's not the law. So you're more than entitled to the person who's passed their body. There are processes that you do need to follow to keep the body cold, and there is time frames around how long you can have it at home, and all that. But you do not need a funeral director, but they will bang on about that until they're black and blue. That you know, mm-hmm. this is a definite. You do need me. That in itself is. It's sneaky. I don't, that's deceit. You know, that's robbing people. And like you said, when that funeral director gave you the smile, it's the same energy behind it. It's just wrong, you know? So in Byron Bay, where I'm living, there's a big community of people that do death in an alternative way. And there's a lot of awareness out there of what your options are. So
cool.
I don't know how that's different in Canada or how that reflects in your country, but in my country it's still dominated by funeral directors and InvoCare and gotta spend the money and all this stuff, but there are alternative options to doing death. Mm-hmm. You know, but I was just, you know, I'm very lucky that I had that training prior, because otherwise I'd just be in a rough sea wanting to get a safe hand, you know, because in those moments
that's like, how I felt.
Yeah you need help, you need help and someone to, because it's a rough sea, you're trying not to drown, you know, and there's moments where you think, fuck, am I actually gonna get out of this? Like it's the most traumatic, crazy seas that you've ever dealt with. And then the only light raft that's around is a funeral director with a light going, jump on my boat. Oh, and by the way, there's a 5-10 grand fee for jumping on my boat. You know, so who's behind that clothing? So yeah, that's a subject in itself, and that's a deep subject. But I'm running out of time slowly. But what I wanted to touch on before we go, because I could literally talk to you probably all day about this subjects is I want to talk to you about New Moon Mirror and the website, and what's that evolving to? What are those gold nuggets in there? Like, I'm really interested to have do you have any sort of forecast for your next 6 months? Do you plan that way? Give me a gold nugget, Mirror. Give me something.
If we'd had any prep for this interview, I would have planned an answer. I'm just kidding. I actually wouldn't have because I don't know. So honestly, like, I am not a very intentional person with all of this stuff. I truly started right. I feel like people are like, are you just saying that? Like, they don't really believe me, but I truly started writing simply because I needed to survive. And I think it sounds so dramatic when I say it, but it's actually true. Like, I primarily write because I feel like I need to, and it helps me. Like, that is the main thing. But it's totally obviously evolving into something else too. And I think for me, like, I do have dreams. So the first thing I'm doing in 2021 is I'm actually going to build the website. And for me, I feel like when I build the website and I write the copy, that's probably when things are going to start falling into place for what I'm actually trying to do. Like, for me, it's often like that, where writing actually fuels, like, I have these glimmers of ideas, but then writing it out and actually creating the words for it, I think will kind of help it fall into place more. But I want to definitely have a place where I can write more long form stuff. So I just started writing on Instagram, pretty much because I didn't have the energy to start a blog. I couldn't even imagine starting a blog, and Instagram was right there, and it was a way that I could connect to other grievers, and there was like a community built in. So that was the only reason I started writing on Instagram, or I guess the potential for a community built in, I guess. Yeah. That was the only reason I started writing on Instagram. But I want the website to be like a place where there can be more long form writing, more longer conversations, a place where I can have all of my published pieces in one place where people can find them, which is already there. Like, that's already all up there. Where I can have like all the different interviews that I've done like this all in one place. Yeah. And then where I can hopefully share, because I'm writing a memoir. I got a grant from the Canada Council for the Arts to essentially like put into a book what I've been doing anyways, which is a sort of memoir style writing about my experience. That's awesome. Thank you. Yeah. That's Thank exciting. You. So it is exciting. Yeah. So I hope to sort of share little bits and pieces as I'm going over there. And then I also want to have a place where I can eventually start building groups and communities of grievers. Like, I have this sort of background in occupational therapists and tons of experience with group leading.
Yeah.
And just kind of this, I think a lot of practice holding space for people through hard things and kind of sort of in that coach role, although I'm not a coach, like I wouldn't call myself a coach, but like in that kind of a role, you know. And I find that happening anyways in my DMs a lot of the time on Instagram. I'm like, I'm kind of being like how I used to be as an OT, but it's different now because I have this lived experience. So it's like a peer as well. And I really, that work really resonates with me too. And I'm really like, honestly, just thinking out loud right now as I speak, because it's only very, very, very recently, like I'm talking within the last like week or two, that I've even started to acknowledge that there might be a connection somewhere between my role as an occupational therapist and my role as a writer within the grief world. I'd also really, really love to create resources, like more educational resources. Like, that's a fire under my ass right now too, is like not only writing about my experience from this memoir type of heart driven perspective, but also actual real resources. And that might be like the OT in me coming out a little bit, but like resources for people to send to their grieving family and friends, resources for people who are grieving to kind of move through their own grief process in ways, sort of using all of this all of this stuff that I have learned over the past almost 2 years. So I do hope to sort of include something like that. And then I have a few like partnerships kind of in the works with like workshops that I'm going to be potentially doing, but that haven't really been solidified yet. So there's a few things, but it's all kind of still a mismatch of, you know, ideas and things.
Yeah. That's really exciting, Mira.
Yeah.
That's really exciting. I can really see you walking beside people through their grief. And that's something that, it's funny that you talk about your goals, because some of your goals are the same as my goals, same as that. And I'll have to talk to you further about that sometime in the future. But how powerful that be is walking beside people through their grief. And even if it's just some tool, something to help them along their way, is so beneficial. But I think like when you said the word coach, I think that word has been, that has been kind of damaged. I know when kind of like,
what is it? I agree.
Like the business coaches, they're just trying to sell you something, you know, you can hit six figures and all that time. So that word kind of has some sort of, you know, charge behind it in some sense. But hey, I just want to like, what I want to acknowledge, Mira, is just how potent you are as a leader and your work that ripple effect. I hope you realize what that ripple effect's doing, because it's touched me. And I just haven't come across someone on the internet that has such a talent with writing, putting words, mind, you know, your feelings and mind, all of that through a platform. So I find you really, really inspirational. And I hope you, like I told you, like in the start of the interview, I hope you're celebrating, as hard as it might be, your small wins, because I feel like that's really, really important for grievers, is acknowledging how far you've come. And I'm not talking about like you need to go and have a party or whatever, but just have acknowledgement of the small wins you're having and the impact that you're having on your community. Like, it's gone as far as Australia, and it's probably gone as far as the world, Mira. So
you're very kind.
And I really want to stay in contact with you, and I really would love to do more of this and maybe dissect certain subjects with you around death, dying and loss and grief and all that. And if you look, if you ever come to Australia, you have to come visit me in Byron Bay.
Okay.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of Byron Bay before?
No, I don't know much about Australia. I've never been, but I would love to one day come.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I ever come your way, I'd love to drop you a line. And
of course I would. Yes, please don't come in the winter though. It's very cold.
I love the cold.
Unless you like really cold. Then come in the winter.
See, Mira, I'm pasty and white and freckly, so I don't really adapt well in I'm probably in the wrong country. Maybe Canada has a better climate. I do rather the winters here, but the winters here are like, we have an average temperature of like 24 degrees. It's crazy.
Oh, wow.
It's crazy.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
That's not to say it doesn't get cold. But Byron Bay is pretty spoilt in that regard. So I'm more a creature of the winter, so to speak.
Okay, so you better come in the winter then.
Yeah, I'll do something like that. But yeah, let's stay in contact. And
for sure.
Thank you so much for being in this space. And, you know,
thank you.
I was so excited to, you know, like I said, like usually my interviews, I'm like, I just freestyle them and just go with what's, and I did that with this interview, but literally I had so many questions for you. And I actually can't touch on all of them today, but we will do that together.
For sure. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It was so nice talking with you. And I really appreciate the conversation and the space that you're opening up for these conversations, because they're so important.
Yeah. Thank you. And say hi to D for me.
I will.
Say hi to Dee for me. I've seen her on the gram, and say hi to her for me. And let's do it again soon. Thank you so much.
Okay. Nice chatting with you, Brent.
Yeah. All right, Mira. Have a good day. Oh, have a good night. I'm having a good day.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.